Greetings, comrades, and welcome to the Eastern Border. And I am, well, I guess I'm going to have to put a thick Russian accent on this one. Comrades, I have successfully infiltrated the capitalist capital. It was weird, but this place is interesting. It's kind of like Moscow, but not really. Yeah, basically I'm in DC and it's really fun, except half of the museums that I wanted to go to are closed, like Air and Space is under renovation, and that's bad. And apparently, if you want to go up the Washington Monument, you can only pre-purchase the tickets when it's, like, if you're a large group, you can pre-purchase them in normal times, but otherwise, you have to wait on each day's 10 a.m. precisely, where they sell the tickets to the next, the following day. And I did that two times in a row, and both of the days, yeah, they got sold out in seconds. I literally clicked on the times I wanted, poof, gone. And then, well, if you are American and if you, have read in the news about the person who in Capitol drove into a wall and then shot himself, yeah, me and my girlfriend were walking towards the Capitol from the other side when that thing happened and then they closed the Capitol down. So, I need to remind you that I'm in the United States. Actually, I love it here. I'm going to talk more about my United States experiences in a long-form episode, which I'm recording later on in about 4 hours with History Impossible, which is going to be sent to Annette and edited. It's not going to be out so soon because Annette needs to edit it probably a day or two or something. But there I'm going to be talking about more kind of in-depth war philosophy and the things that Smithsonian museums made you think about democracy and about the monuments and more general subject things. Not just news, because you know, I met some of you here. Really, really thank you. And, well, like I said, a lot of my United States experiences is going to be in this show that I'm recording in about 4 hours with Alexander from History Impossible. And listen to that. There's going to be a lot of shout-outs. And, well, although no one sponsors me here, I'm going to give you my, well, best places where I've eaten and where I've been. And, you know, this is going to be kind of a relief because after the event, it was a bit different. However, this episode was supposed to come out yesterday with all the news from the front. Because, you know, we're back in business. But then a bunch of weird events happened, which I had to dig in and realize and understand what was going actually on and everything. So I'll start with a big one. Because, you know, like I said, trip experiences in a long-form episode, because I had a lot to talk about, both outside the context of this war and in the context of this war. But, First of all, about Igor Girkin. You might have heard that there's a lot of rumors and reports going on that Igor Girkin shaved off his mustache and his hair, and he went to Crimea to get to the front lines. To, you know, he got so angry about the failures of the Russian military that he decided to go to the front lines, and apparently he was arrested there. In Crimea, he was caught and arrested because he was using fake documents and whatever. Well, now, I spent 2 days and I literally skipped going to Lincoln Monument for a day just to do this, and it's a bit tiring recording this when you're just seeing all the sights. However, here is the exact information that I know of that is confirmable that I know what happened with Igor Girkin these days. See, Igor Girkin, also known as Strelkov, also known as my frenemy, he had missed and skipped his publication date because he usually on Fridays spends about an hour or so talking with his Russian friends, though the ultra-nationalist mega-pro-war and also anti-Putin at the same time, ultra-monarchist crazies with contacts with Donetsk military and all this stuff. This is where Murs comes from, this is where Mikhail Kalashnikov from Roy TV spouts his nonsense, you know, all this good stuff that we use. So, he had missed this one, and his kind of posts had become less frequent in recent times and not as long. So, you know, I had to switch to other sources, but I'm always interested whenever he posts something. And, well, his buddy, Igor Bezler, one of his kind of buddies, posted that he was kind of arrested in Crimea, and everyone saw the picture of Igor Girkin without, you know, his mustache and with shaved hair. So what happened was, Igor Girkin specifically stated, he commented on this picture that he's been arrested and all this stuff. He stated specifically 3 points, which we dug through. One, to comment Igor Nikolaevich Belzer is not to respect myself. Two, I have never sat in jail. Specifically, the isolator for temporary KPZ, KPZ, basically temporary lockdown jail. Like, if you get arrested, you get to put in this temporarily. He denies specifically that. Third, I will be, sooner or later, I'll be on the front lines, because this war, anyways, this war, like I said before, will be long and heavy, but not right now, end quote. This is what he denies. So basically, I can, out of all of my sources and news, including Arestovich, whom I also double-check every time, what happened with Girkin is that he used not a fake passport, this I found out, by the way, he used an old agency passport given to him by the KGB, now FSB, well, the same organization, basically. He had undercover passports. He took one of those passports under some other name, but it's not a fake one. Technically, it's just given to him by his government special services, and he just kept it in use. And with that passport, he tried to smuggle himself to the front lines. Then he went to Crimea, and he wasn't exactly arrested, as he was, well, stopped from going, prevented from going to the front lines. And this is very exact words, since arrested means he's put into jail, he's sent away, all that stuff. But apparently, as far as I know from my private sources, and, well, putting together my private sources, OSINT, I just went to the spy museum, I have a lot of things to say, but I can tell that I'm OSINT apparently now. From OSINT and other kind of important sources, I can piece together that Igor Girkin shaved his head, well, cut it down, shaved his mustache. Then he went to Crimea, was prevented from going to the front lines, and he states that he will not go to the front lines right now in the closest days, but he will be there eventually. Apparently, even according to Arestovich, he was let go, although Arestovich claims Girkin's made his way to the front lines. I am a bit skeptical about that. I think he's near the front lines in Crimea, and I think Igor Girkin is now in contact with people in Donetsk, previously with him in Donetsk and those eastern parts, who are now there in Kherson, around these places where the counterattack is going on, where the fighting is heaviest, because apparently Russia has moved about 60% of their total forces in Kherson, because, well, my theory keeps proving correct that Russia just doesn't want any major victories for Ukraine, because a single one might disrupt the whole house of cards. Basically, Igor Girkin's on free, because he apparently had used his contacts not to get into huge trouble, although his buddies and, like-minded folks as him keep getting arrested. That settles the Girkin question, at least. To my best information, he might be arrested as I record this, but I pieced together that he's not in jail, he's not being sent anywhere, he was just prevented to go straight to front lines and interrogated, but then let go. And according to Arestovich, he's on front lines, but I don't believe that, he's somewhere near. We'll see. I think that he's more or less safe, because he also posted a new, kind of very short, look at the situation in the front, which I'm going to give you right now. And he again talks in oblast positions. Kharkiv Oblast. Basically, nothing is happening there. Which is kind of silly, you know, you start with something where nothing's happening, but it is what it is. Front from Siversk to Soledar to Bakhmut. Again, no significant movements, but there are street fighting in both, you know, in the streets of these places. I don't really know how big they are. Some of them are big, some of them are smaller, but I think Siversk is pretty, pretty big. But there are street fighting in Siversk, and there are active battles going on in the outskirts of Bakhmut and Soledar. There are also kind of battles of local tactical importance, basically to the north and in northwest to Gorlovka. Gorlovka was the place which Ukrainians heavily bombarded, and there was active artillery fire going on there. And basically in this region, Girkin reports that very, very slowly Ukrainians retreat. However, well, very slowly, you might think it's 10 meters a day, but, you know, it might be like 2 to 3 meters per day, because the average amount that the Russians have moved is super tiny. Now Donetsk. Again. Interestingly enough, Donetsk front, he states without any changes. He states that there is active fighting in the northwest of Pyski and in Marinka. Meanwhile, Russian official governments, government position is that Pyski has been taken, completely conquered, Yeah, holy, for now, for sure. Except that if you've been listening to my show, then I had been reporting that official Russian position was that Pisky had been completely conquered even before I left the United States. Even before I left Latvia to go to the United States, just to be clear. Yeah, I'm sorry for this, like my hotel room, and thanks to the person who booked this for me, it's great. Because, you know, someone had a lot of points and they just booked me a hotel room. Awesome. This hotel room has this conditioner AC coming straight up at me when I'm sitting, and I don't know how to regulate the thing, so my right side's pretty cold, but yeah. Anyhow, either Pesky have been taken for the sixth time in 2 weeks, which is, I don't know, or there's heavy fighting there, but basically extremely slow movement. Then there's the district of Uglegorsk. There, he claims, tactical success for the armed forces of the Donetsk and Luhansk People's Republics. And during two last 24-hour periods, which we call sutka, or day-night period, day-night cycle, 24 hours, sutka is a great name in Russian, by the way, a few fortified points of Ukrainian army have been taken. I'm not sure about that, but might be true. Kherson and Zaporozhye. Artillery and positional fighting, which is great because Ukrainian army isn't rushing into their kind of positions and everything. That artillery battles with this might be good. And then front from Kharkov to the border with Belarus. Again, regular exchanges of artillery and rocket fire. And he specifies that there's a lot of strikes in the territory of Russian Federation, which is important because you see. At one point, I kind of understood that, you know, it would be nice to legally ensure that, you know, when we're talking about striking Russian Federation soil from Ukrainian perspective. Sure, I think Ukraine could be given these long-range missiles as long as they strike the positions in Russia where army units are focused and basically where the strikes are based from. If Russia fires missiles at Ukraine from a certain position inside Russia, then Ukraine should be able to strike them. I spoke with a listener today, by the way, hi, not going to mention any names here for privacy reasons, obviously, but yeah, I think Ukraine should just be able to strike Russia whatever they strike Ukraine from. If Ukraine decides to strike further inland, that could give Putin actual legitimate reason, and, you know, he could push this through popularly to mobilize Russia, but strikes inside Russian territory from which Russians are striking Ukraine, that seems very reasonable and nice and actually something that should be done to, well, expedite the Ukrainian victory. In other news of this whole war thing, and this comes from Dmilov, by the way, and I'll exchange this one and I'll end this one with Prigozhin situation and with the strike at the base of Wagner, but just some minor news in between. In the occupied towns of Lugansk district, Russian soldiers, in exchange for produce or money, find out on local retired people, pensioners, information about men in the conscription age. This is being stated by the head of the Luhansk military administration, Sergei Gaidai. They legit are basically telling soldiers to give some money to local poor tired people to find out where those few who have not yet been conscripted are hiding so that they could be sent to the meat grinder. This is always a fun thing. Workers of Mosvoda Canal, that's Moscow water channel, kind of basically irrigation systems, aqueducts, that sort of thing for Moscow. Soviet Union loved its abbreviations. These people basically have been forced to go to the city of Shastya. The city is called Shastya. That means, well, luck or good luck in Russian. Basically, this city of Shastya, it's a town basically. It's under control of the Luhansk People's Republic, and they're not being paid at all, and they haven't even received their contracts as well. Interestingly enough, yeah, this just means that Russian Federation is just deciding to, we'll pay you later, do slave labor now. It's kind of funny that the side that claims to be fighting against Nazis uses, you know, cheats its own people who are being forcibly sent on hostile ground to fix up bombed stuff, and then not paying them, essentially using slave labor. Always fun. In the Kakhovska hydroelectric station, one turbine has been switched off, and basically the whole hydroelectric station now works in emergency regime. TASS states this. Ukrainian forces claim that the bridge to this hydroelectric dam has been taken out, which is great. A lot of these dams near Kherson region have been taken out, a lot of bridges. Another strike happened at Antonovka, which means that Russian forces are now basically, they have gone back to the positions, which you know, they've crossed the Dnieper, and although there's no active movement by the Ukrainian forces, and I still have to watch, by the way, Perun's new video where he claims that Ukraine has a lot of manpower, not enough tanks, which is what I always state. Ukraine needs heavy weaponry and heavy armaments because they have manpower. They lack technology. Russia has all the tanks, but they lack the men, actually, to man them. So, you know, we should provide Ukraine with tanks because we can do that. We can't provide them with men. Anyway, they're bombing the bridges. Slovakia is now giving Ukraine its MiG-29 fighter planes. This, by the way, has been stated by the state channel RTV, yes, the same, with basically Yaroslav Nadia, who is the Minister of Defense of the country. Pro-Russian channels, pro-Russian Telegram channels have already been stating that, oh, MiG-29, they're nothing, they're useless. Even though Russia continues to use them, they state it's like, well, not nice, but, you know, not tragic either. Ukraine has now stated that out of the occupied Energograd, next to that is a kind of a nuclear power station, which is kind of prone to Russian sabotage because Russian soldiers keep being stationed in the nuclear power plant, and then they're accusing Ukraine of trying to cause a nuclear blast, even though it's most likely their own doings or whatever, but mass evacuation is happening there, and everyone's kind of going away. Fun story from our neighbors of Estonia and Finland. Basically, Finns and Estonians intend to close off, and if you look at the map of the world, look where Estonia's capital Tallinn is located. It was also known as Reval before that, by the way, in German times, just some random history. Basically, Tallinn and Helsinki are so close that if you take a ferry, it'll take you about two and a half hours to cross through that. It's not a kind of a very wide gap. It's a tiny gap, and apparently they've already coordinated the thing that'll basically close all Russian shipping going from St. Petersburg port. They're going to close the rest of the Baltic Sea to Russian military ships. Just as soon as Finland becomes a full-fledged NATO member. Which means that, well, Swedish listeners, rejoice. You're going to have less Russian submarines in your waters. Because, yeah, previously Finland wasn't a NATO member, and Russia just, you know, tended to poke at us in the Baltics and Sweden and sometimes North Germany and sometimes Denmark, you know, territorial waters with their subs and do all sorts of provocative things. But now Tallinn and Helsinki have decided to basically, yeah, you know, we can just close the gap and not let anyone through. Baltic Sea has, well, about to turn into a NATO lake, which I find extremely nice. Merchant vessels will not be affected, but not like they can stand anywhere. Poland also has stated that they'll stop giving out visas to the citizens of Russia. But basically, they don't give out tourist visas for a couple of months. And, you know, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia are doing the same, except certain conditions or whatever. But I think that's kind of a political mistake. For one, that keeps anti-Putin Russians inside of the country. I mean, their argument. I mean, I'm looking at a lot of Russian liberals on TV and on YouTube, and Russian liberals state that this gives basically armament to Russian propaganda that, well, you see, the fact that Putin claims that this is a proxy war of the rest of the world versus Russia and they hate us just because we're Russians, this gives them ammo. The counter-argument that I've heard from a lot of people is that, yeah, you know, it's so cool and amazing from you to just go to our countries in the EU and everywhere else and just sit through the war while people are suffering and you get all the benefits and you do nothing. You basically run away from your country. Basically, you get to live in the Western world and you're just sitting there not providing any goods. We will still give, well, apparently Baltics and Poland will still give asylum to those people who are actively persecuted by Putin's regime, of course. But if you're just a random rich guy who just wants to sit the war out somewhere out there and, you know, still want to, you know, not do anything against Putin, and if you're too lazy for that, that's a thing, because a lot of these people could also just be Putin's agents. It's a double-edged sword, and I don't personally think that total cutoff of visas is a solution, but I can clearly see why it's being done. I mean, what else can we do? What else is the pressure that we can apply? From one side, yeah, sure, that keeps people who are harmful to Putin's regime, and Putin can use this to, you know, hurt every, or like, yell that, look, they're not letting us in. However, out of in Russia, only about 10% of the population ever have traveled abroad. So 90% of the people, you know, they already think that EU and the West are totally against Russians. And those guys are the ones who support the war in Ukraine, so it's a tough moral situation. Bit of a more in-depth coming in my episode that I'm going to record this evening, but that's going to be mostly American stuff, intertwined with some things that I learned from Smithsonian. And yeah, well, Fitch and Standard & Poor's have also kind of decreased the financial ratings of Ukraine to default levels, because they basically managed the deal to pay off their external debt. However, while Ukraine and Ukrainian government have ensured that basically they've put up their payments for their debt interest up until 2024, and they already basically live off, because their economy is in shambles, they're at war, they're being conquered, they're being bombed at. Of course, they don't have proper financing. Whatever taxes they pull in, it's already weird. So yeah, I mean, when Russia went, you know, when Russia defaulted, it didn't matter because no one wanted to give them money, since they already had been, you know, they're at war, everyone's already leaving their country, nothing will change in their investments. Ukraine, well, Ukraine's receiving a ton of aid and they can't make the payments, they're being invaded, so this is one, in normal situations, countries go in default and being bankrupt basically because they can't pay, or for various reasons, that would be a massive tragedy. But right now with the war, we'll solve the financial niceties as well. This is one of the situations where economy and economists just have to, you know, go out of the window, because not like it matters. And yeah, at this point, there are still protests in Russia and everything. But what I want to finish this episode with is, a lot of people have asked me, has Prigozhin died? And let me tell you, no, he hasn't. That's the thing. Apparently, a Russian war journalist named Sreda, or Wednesday, he apparently had posted on his webpage that I went to this here town and met some private warfare group Wagner people. And, you know, after 2 days, it was blown up and Prigozhin was seen somewhere near. And then some artillery was destroyed. I didn't even pay attention to these news until you guys on Twitter started poking me. By the way, our Twitter is @Eastern_border. Please follow us. We're trying to get to 20,000 followers. But yeah, you see, Prigozhin is a known troll, and Russian military have acted dumbly, but in normal ways. See, basically, yeah, they've revealed their positions, but unless this Sreda guy is ridiculously dumb and idiotic to such an extent that even I, the cynical me, which knows that sometimes in the Russian army, people in training are not allowed to hit their targets because that would ruin the targets and you have to account for them and all the corruption. Even I don't believe he's that ridiculously dumb. I'm trying to apply charity principle here, okay? Counterintelligence team, where I got my news from this one, even the guy interviewing them states that, no, it's quite likely that Russians are that dumb and that incompetent. But counterintelligence team basically looks and reports this as kind of like, and in this one specific case, this doesn't look like Russians being dumb. This looks like Prigozhin's troll move. Why? Because Prigozhin, specifically the guy who is in Wagner Group, and only because this is Wagner Group. If this was Russian regular army, I would say, yep, dumb war reporter who left out the positions and dumb people who blew it up. However, in this very specific case, I think that Prigozhin just trolling with him being dead, and he wants to, you know, he wants to draw some artillery fire on his positions on that random building, because the guy was greeted and he posted the position on an open street, and that's kind of retarded because you'd have to go inside the building of the people, you know, of the military base to not reveal their positions. But Prigozhin's known to do trolling acts. Prigozhin has bought up all of Navalny's debt and let it go just to troll them. and then, you know, sue them. Prigozhin's also sued everyone in Russia who even spoke against him. Prigozhin's kind of like, he's pulled a lot of mean pranks inside of Russia. I should make a special episode about all these mean pranks, but he's known for trolling and the whole kind of very open positional thing. I think he's pulling some sort of a long game here. I don't believe Prigozhin's dead. But, you know, that about wraps it up. Again, sorry for the small amount of episodes. It's just that, you know, I've been talking to people, meeting listeners, and then doing some tourist stuff. And when I come back at my home, whatever I'm staying, or at a hotel, it's about 10 p.m. and I just want to pass out. And I want to make a great episode. Like, I was super tired in my last one in Maine, even, you know. So I hope this one's better. And like I said, in about, what is this now? In about 4 hours, maybe three at this point, I think four, we're recording with History Impossible, Alexander von Rattenberg, and then I'm going to be talking about America stuff and some interesting philosophical ideas. And Alexander asked me not to talk about Salman Rushdie, so we'll do that. And let me remind you that throughout this month and until I go back to Ukraine, which is going to be in, you know, some point in September, we are collecting money for a drone to a personal squad that I know of Ukrainians. And yeah, if you wanna, you can just click the donate button on the easternborder.lv website and just, you know, basically change the support the Eastern Border little thing to for the drone thing, and I'll just put it in the drone funds because everything goes into the drone funds. If you want to support the show specifically, please become our patron at patreon.com/easternborder, or just click the little money button on kind of our Twitter page. Also, if you go to theeasternborder.lv, you can listen to all the shows without ads, which is a recommended way because, you know, I don't get almost any advertisement money anyways. It's not a huge part of this. I'm your funded. I'm funded by Patreon and your donations. And yeah, most of the ad money goes for hosting expenses and all this stuff. And yeah, basically for everything. So feel free to listen to this without ads. Of course, every Patreon also gets each episode without ads. And that's the business side away. I'm being told that, you know, I should also state that, hey, if any of you have any connections in, I don't know, higher education, because in some of the talks, people told me that, hey, if I was intending to do my PhD, you know, if anyone knows anything about scholarships and a PhD program that I could work, or some think tank that I could, you know, get into as the war ends, because I'm planning to do that, please let us know. Write us an email. I'd be happy to work with a think tank or something like that. Because, yeah, doing my PhD abroad would also, I think, be a boon or something. And finally, America's a really nice place. I like it here. The cities on the East Coast are vastly different from each other. And I've eaten a lot of your local foods, and I enjoy this place. До свидания, товарищи. And remember, happiness is mandatory.